Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking Truth to Empire on KFCF 88.1 FM Free Speech Radio for Central California. My name is Dan Yassin and I'm an anti-war and anti-empire activist. Mike Rhodes is at the control. Today is April 19, 2017, third Wednesday of the month. Every third Wednesday from 3 to 3:30 p.m., I interview authors, bloggers, columnists, and activists who help us look at our world through the prism of American imperialism. On the show, we talk about U.S. foreign and domestic policies and the actions of the military-industrial surveillance congressional complex. These actions have severe consequences not only for the people in the United States, but many people in other countries. To create a better, humane, and a compassionate world, we must first understand what is being done in our name, and we must always be willing to stand up, speak out, and speak truth to empire. Today we have Kathy Kelly on telephone with us. Hello, Kathy.
Oh, hello, Dan. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for being my guest on the show. Kathy Kelly, a peace and justice activist, is a 3-times Nobel Peace Prize nominee. She co-coordinates Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. Kathy will be the keynote speaker on Saturday, May 6th, for the 25th anniversary of the Fresno Center for Nonviolence. We will talk more about this later in the program. Kathy, many of our listeners are familiar with you, your activism, and your numerous trips to Iraq and Afghanistan, but only few people know about Voices of Creative Nonviolence, your group, and dedicated activists that work with you. Tell us about Voices.
Well, this evening we just paused for a dinner break, and we're happy to welcome a young man who's a Jesuit seminarian who is on pilgrimage and walked in our door unexpected, and he's been a wonderful surprise. We also were joined by a woman from Albany, New York, who's come to volunteer with us for 2 weeks. She's a playwright, and we hope that maybe she can help us develop some effective street theater regarding our deep, deep concerns about Yemen. Sabia Rigby and I and Brian Terrell are here often. Sometimes we're away as well, and our community is often in flux and changes, but we've been fortunate to be together with really some of the most interesting and dedicated people imaginable. Laurie Hasbrook is another name you see, and Sean Reynolds signing our newsletters. And so we work hard together, but we do laugh and we enjoy one another's companionship, and I think that's so necessary, as we've also seen with our young friends in Kabul, building community, finding kindred spirits, and believing that we have deep responsibilities, but that there's also a lot of capability that can be kind of energized and enacted as we try very, very hard to stop the United States militarism, stop the United States wars.
I know you've been doing it for a long time, and I guess you've gone to Afghanistan over 20 times, Iraq many, many more times. We'll probably we'll talk more about the work you have done. Let's get on to what's going on the current affairs. I think we are at a critical juncture as far as the nuclear confrontation with Russia, China, and North Korea is concerned. Obama was responsible for surrounding both Russia and China with military bases equipped with nukes, and he did many exercises, military NATO, U.S. NATO exercises right on the border of Russia. Give us your perspective, especially after Trump's recent attack on Syria and dropping of largest non-nuclear bomb in Afghanistan and his belligerence towards North Korea.
Well, I think we're certainly looking at a very erratic and unpredictable presidency. It may be that a sort of more suave mask was put on previous residents of the Oval Office, whether it was Barack Obama or Clinton or the Bushes. But they also certainly unleashed, as you've mentioned, horrific attacks and encircled and kind of fenced in people with whom we might have been trying to make friends. And that would have been, I think, a much better development with regard to Russia, with regard to China. And I think even with regard to North Korea, we should be asking, what do the people in North Korea need? What do they want? And not trying to push people into a corner and not emphasizing so much the demonization of the leaders of other countries. But this practice of basing foreign policy on threat and on force is nothing new. It's what we see now is a manifestation of what had gone on before, but as I say, it's a much more erratic and unpredictable presidency with President Trump. And, you know, even today, General Mattis has met with leaders of Saudi Arabia, and now he's heading next to Israel, and before that, Egypt, and then he'll go to Qatar. So, you know, he's trying to, apparently, to say that the United States wants to strengthen Saudi Arabia. Well, I believe that's going to make the United States more complicit in Saudi war crimes as they're being enacted in Yemen at a terrible cost of life today. So we wish that the order of the day would be negotiation and dialogue and peace building and usage of humanitarian aid to try to help bring people to the negotiating table. But instead, I think the manufacturing companies, the military contractors that make these weapon systems and these terrible bombs and outfit armies, they want nothing more than to see further conflict, further bloodshed, further retaliation and enmity.
Yeah. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I know one thing that happened every time there is a big attack and all that, and the next day the stocks of these companies that make these missiles and bomb, as you mentioned, their stocks go up. You have many friends in Afghanistan, and you are constantly in touch because you go there all the time. Tell us about what you have heard from your friends in Afghanistan about this huge bomb that was dropped by Trump in Achin district of Nangarhar province.
People, of course, feel very, very vulnerable, as though their lives don't count, that if the United States wants to experiment with a big, huge bomb, the largest non-nuclear bomb in its arsenal, they can just do it in Afghanistan, and there won't be much of a challenge to that. So people feel vulnerable. I'm sure there's a great deal of panic closer to the area. It's interesting that no one is being allowed to go in, not the Afghan army, not the Afghan police. Mm. The United States is keeping people out of the area, and so it's very difficult to know what were the consequences of that bombing. But it's unthinkable that there wouldn't be contaminated water with that amount of explosives and chemicals being unleashed in a one-mile radius and a bomb that detonated above the ground, that the land won't be arable, and that people who were nearby are going to want to flee. And already in Kabul, there are huge, sprawling refugee camps, and they're just wretched, Dan. They're terrible places. People don't have latrines. They don't have access to potable water. They have no means to have wood and, you know, start a wood-burning fire, so people in the cold weather burn tires and garbage and plastics. And so the air is horrible, and when the snow and the rain comes, it's just sludge that people have to kind of try to cope with. They're primitive huts, sometimes just poles and tarps under which people are living, whole families with children. And why? Because they're so afraid. In areas where there's aerial terrorism, where the United States has with drones or with airstrikes fired bombs, or where they think there's going to be retaliation coming from the Taliban, people just pick up and run. And then they face terrible hunger and thirst and disease. So these are realities that I think a lot of people in the United States don't think very much about when they hear that a major big bomb has been exploded. They might hear, well, that was meant to send a message to the North Koreans. And, well, what about the people in Afghanistan who, in all of these years since 2001, when the United States has invaded and occupied, their conditions have grown more and more miserable?
I guess you mentioned that sentence, and whenever I hear that, whatever we do, we can shoot 59 missiles at Syria, and we can do all kind of provocation, and they are just called sending a message. But when other countries do that, then they are provocating, they are threatening, so that's very common how the mainstream media talks about these things. So I don't know how many messages we have to keep sending to the world. Let's just move on to your article that you wrote, the last one I saw, Angry, Desperate, Rejected. And you point out the worst famine in over 70 years that is happening in four countries: Yemen, Nigeria, Somalia, and South Sudan. So what I want to talk, you'd like you to talk about is you have the people that you work with in Afghanistan, Afghan peace volunteers, and you have a wonderful story about your travel to a small village from Kabul to attend the celebration of marriage of Abid and Zaro. Tell us about that, and from there go on and tell us about your work in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, we're so fortunate. Now over 8 years, we've had a chance to watch young people mature and become wonderful young adults, and you know, they get married and have children, and those are very good celebrations. Of course, the wedding culture is extremely expensive, and it can take generations to come up with the funding and overcome the debts that are involved in weddings. And people often just simply don't have employment. They don't have jobs, and that weighs very, very heavily on the minds of my young friends. How are they going to support their families? How might they ever begin new families? And yet, you know, I certainly am happy to see joyous occasions when people are dancing and the women are brightly clad, and of course, the women and the men are also very, very separated, but going out to a village was just a joy, getting outside of Kabul and breathing clean air and seeing the mulberry trees and the almond trees and the grapevines. That was really quite lovely. But I do have to say that the people in the refugee camps who cope with those problems I mentioned actually are not so different from average ordinary Kabulis in the matter of everybody breathing terribly poisoned air. And the open sewage system means that there's much more likelihood of respiratory infections and disease. And there's no clean water available in Kabul. You have to boil your water and do your best to try to prevent people from getting waterborne diseases. The healthcare system has pretty well collapsed. There's electricity maybe every other day. My friends cook over a single cylinder gas flame, and there's no refrigeration. I mean, it's a fairly primitive way of living. And you know, meanwhile, the United States has poured billions and billions of dollars into its military presence in Afghanistan, and even $118 billion in non-military aid. But how can you account for it? You know, you can't see improvements or anything even close to nation building. It's still got one of the most corrupt governments in the world. And so, you know, my young friends nevertheless joined me in being very, very concerned for people in Yemen and in South Sudan, in Nigeria, and in Somalia, because they've kept in touch with statistics about world hunger and severe acute malnourishment, both as it has afflicted people in Afghanistan but also in other countries. And they can see that the United States is teaming up with, allying with Saudi Arabia, and this is creating more hatred and revenge and desire for retaliation, because the Saudis have not only, since they entered in on the second year of a terrible civil war and decided to uphold one side, they've waged constant airstrikes. And the United States has helped by helping their jet planes refuel in the air and by giving support for the idea of a blockade of a major port in Yemen, the port of Hodeidah. And with the blockade and the airstrikes, the situation has grown more and more desperate, so that the United Nations is now saying that it's almost ready to tip into famine conditions. And then, as you mentioned, there's a trio of near-famine conditions, also conflict-fueled, developing in South Sudan, Nigeria, and Somalia. And interestingly, you know, the United States took in 2016, in terms of refugees, 89,995 refugees. Yemen, this country I've just been talking about that's so desperate, took in 117,000 refugees and has been home to 225,000 Somalis who have fled drought and very, very difficult conditions in Somalia. And, of course, they get to Yemen and they realize this is no place to be. I read from Iona Craig writing for The Intercept about people who had walked miles and miles and thought they were going to reach a place where they'd get some kind of food relief or some kind of water, and there's nothing there. The elders are eating the trees. And so some Somalis set off 140 in a boat and thought, you know, let's get out of here and try to go somewhere else. And then an Apache helicopter, it had to be either a U.S. or a Saudi plane, attacked the ship, and 42 Somalis were killed. Well, you know, this means 42 possible breadwinners for 42 families. It means 42 families are bereaved. It means that, you know, people will begin to think, well, the only way we can protect ourselves is to pick up a gun or join a militia or be part of some armed, more powerful group. And that's a, you know, is supposed to bring us security. What I want to say is there are no military solutions in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Yemen, and yet constantly U.S. people are told your money, your taxes must pay for an expanded, growing, bloated military so that the United States can keep on sending troops and keep on sending weapons all and selling weapons all over the world.
Kerry, I think we have Angela online with us. Hi, Angela.
Well, hi, Dan. Hi. And hi, Kathy. Meeting you for the first time over the airwaves. So
well,
looking forward
to
getting to know you.
I'm looking forward to being in Fresno.
Yes, that will be great. So I actually wanted to call in, Dan, because I wanted to give your listeners a little more information about our 25th anniversary. And that's going to be Saturday, May 6th, 2017, of course, at 6 p.m., and the doors open at 5:30. And it's going to be at the Big Red Church. That's the First Congregational Church at 2131 North Van Ness Boulevard. And so tickets for dinner includes dessert and wine. And it's being catered by the Tree of Life Cafe and Bakery, and we're really happy to be working with them. Tickets are going to be $40, but you get a table of eight for $300. But there are also speaker-only tickets at 7 p.m., and those are $20 and $15 for students and low-income. And you'll also get dessert. I don't think that's on the, but we will give them dessert as well. So now tickets can be obtained from any center board member and by mail or in person at our center, which is at 15854 North Van Ness. And the number there to get more information is 559-237-3223. And you know, I am so looking forward to this. And I know we'll get a fantastic turnout, but I do urge people to get tickets. So do you have any other questions, Dan, that maybe I haven't told you about the event? Or?
No, I think you covered everything, where, when, and how much. So you gave the number. You can repeat the number. People can call, or I will repeat it, 237-3223. That's Center for Nonviolence, and they're open 11 to 3. You can call or stop by there and pick up your
Monday
ticket.
Monday to Friday, yes. Yeah.
Monday through Friday.
So,
yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. It's been very interesting listening to you, Kathy, and I'll be getting to know you much better on the 6th of May.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. I understand, Kathy, that the topic you have chosen for your appearance in Fresno is confronting state violence at home and abroad. Tell us about the state violence that you're going to talk about, and why is it important for us to confront this violence?
Well, I think that as our police stations become more and more militarized, and as people have felt so vulnerable, people of color, to attacks, either while they're in police custody or sometimes if a policeman apprehends a young person of color, it's happened again and again that the person is beaten and sometimes killed. And so this is certainly one instance of state violence. I also think our mass incarceration in the United States is a manifestation of terrible state violence. And I've been in prison. I most recently had spent 3 months in prison in 2015 in a federal prison, and prior to that, 3 months in 2005 and 1 year way back in 1988. But when you go inside the prison system, you begin to realize the kind of collateral consequences of imprisonment, the family breakup, the unemployment people face when they are released, the stigma, the disenfranchisement, the ways in which people are very vulnerable to getting pulled back into the prison system, into this terrible prison industrial complex. And a lot of times it seems like what fuels the ongoing massive incarceration is a combination of corporate profits and government jobs. And so it is important. It's difficult, but it's important to ask what kinds of jobs are really worthwhile, what kind of work should be done, and what kind of work perhaps shouldn't be done. I feel the same way about the military-industrial complex. You know, what fuels that? Government jobs and corporate profits. But should there be a job working to develop nuclear weapons or conventional weapons or the means to ship our young people off to other lands and tell them that they have to be involved in killing and then find out that when they come back amongst the combat veterans, 22 per day are killing themselves? There are some kinds of work that shouldn't exist. And then how do we convert? It might be disruptive, but how do we convert away from the destructive, militarized economies into a kind of an economy that can help us go through the travails we face with global warming and set up an environment that is more harmonious with living on this planet and learning to live together with other people without killing one another?
Last week, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, along with other peace groups, did a week-long vigil and fast for Yemen to bring attention to feminine Saudi-U.S. war in Yemen. On Monday, April 10, Peace Fresno did a protest locally in solidarity with your vigil and fast, and some of us did fast on that day. You have already talked about it. If you want to add anything or just give us a report, were at Code Pink was the other big group that joined you. So give us a report about how did that go.
Well, we were so impressed that Code Pink in Washington, D.C. went to the embassy, the Yemeni embassy, and met with the ambassador. And they said, look, you know, it's not up to us to choose one side or another, but we do encourage every side to silence the guns, engage in negotiation and diplomacy, and certainly we will campaign for the Saudis to lift the blockade and for the United States to stop airstrikes and psychological operations and special operations, and likewise the Saudis. You know, when President Trump addressed both houses of Congress, I know this is some time back, but Chief Petty Officer Ryan Owens had been killed, and his widow was there, and the congresspeople on both sides of the aisle stood and applauded for 4 minutes while she wept, and she was a newly bereaved widow, and President Trump told her, you know your husband is up there, he's hearing you, and he'll be remembered. But never, ever, ever in that whole stretch did anyone ever mention what country he had been killed in. Well, it was Yemen. And no one ever mentioned that on the same night that he was killed, 29 civilians were killed, including women and children, 16 women and children. And nobody mentioned that in that small village when the airstrikes began, some women and children tried to run, and they were killed as they tried to run away, killed by American forces. Nobody mentioned that Yemen is on the brink of starvation and that it's a country that's been afflicted by so many airstrikes and by blockade, and the United States participating in that on a daily basis. None of that was mentioned, and that's what we mean when we talk about exceptionalism, that it's exceptional that one U.S. person, a Navy SEAL who was part of one of these terrifying night raids, bursting into the homes of people and scaring the daylights out of people and traumatizing them perhaps for life. I'm sorry he was killed. The other people in the region thought it was a rival tribe, and they came running with their guns, and there was a battle, and I'm very sorry this man was killed, but we have to recognize that other people's lives are valuable also, and that these villagers meant us no harm. And when we go in with our guns blazing and we enact aerial terrorism, dropping bombs and firing at people, and this creates conditions of far less security for people in the United States. Our security is founded and based in extending a hand of friendship to other people.
Kathy, last year you joined a group organized by Sharon Tennyson of Center for Citizen Initiatives that visited Russia for citizen-to-citizen diplomacy. You went to, I think, about 5 cities, and you talked to many Russians. Give us a report of that trip and why it is.
At no point did we ever hear anybody say, we want war. And yet, NATO exercises were happening that summer. The Anaconda exercises were taking place all along the Russian border with the Baltic countries. And, there was clear saber rattling, and the Russians would have reason to fear that people in the United States might want war. Now, I do want to mention that Zbigniew Brzezinski and Thomas Graham, two people who were architects of the Cold War, meaning they built up the Cold War conditions and perpetuated that war, they, at the point when we were traveling, had both filed articles in 2 separate conservative magazines saying that maybe it was time for the United States to recognize that the age of United States hegemony is over, and that we would have to start to compromise with Russia and with China. Well, I hope that wouldn't be a compromise to, have a triumvirate of countries trying to control other people's resources, but one in which people would say, let's work together to tackle the very real problems we all face, especially global warming and world hunger and the lack of clean water, these kinds of things that these major powers could resolve and not be fighting proxy wars amongst one another. So it was instructive, certainly, to meet people who were warm and friendly and hospitable toward us. I think many Russians honestly do say, look, we want a period of stability, to be in Leningrad and St. Petersburg and walk through the cemetery dedicated to people who died during the siege of Leningrad, a terrible time of mass starvation when people were buried in unmarked graves, and realize that 22 to 27 million people died in Russia in World War II. And very little thanks was...
Kathy, we have less than a minute left, so you want to wrap it up?
Mm-hmm. Well, very little thanks was ever said to Russian people for sacrifices they made. So I guess I just want to reiterate that chance to extend a hand of friendship. Sharon Tennyson will be taking a new group of 100 people
over to
Russia in May. It'll be good to keep track of that.
Okay. Thank you for being my guest on the show. I'm looking forward to see you on May 6th.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Bye-bye. You were listening to Speaking Truth to Empire on KFCF 88.1 FM, Free Speech Radio for Central California. And we were speaking with peace activist Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. My name is Dan Yassin, host of the show. Thank you for listening. Until next time.